21. Illumination. With the fall of the Iron Citadel, the war on Aureus was over. The Brotherhood was destroyed as a fighting force, and though there were still pockets of resistance to be mopped up, the fighting was as good as over. Casualties on both sides had been high, most especially in the army units of the expedition. Hector Varvarus was brought back to the fleet with due reverence, and his body returned to space in a ceremony attended by the highest-ranking officers of the expeditions. The War Master himself spoke the Lord Commander's eulogy, the passion and depths of his sorrow plain to see.
"Heroism is not only in the man, but in the occasion," the War Master had said of Lord Commander Varvarus. "It is only when we look now and see his success that men will say that it was good fortune. It was not. We lost thousands of our best warriors that day, and I feel the loss of every one. Hector Varvarus was a leader who knew that to march with the gods, one must wait until he hears their footsteps sounding through events, and then leap up and grasp the hem of their robes. Varvarus has gone from us, but he would not want us to pause in mourning, for history is a relentless master. It has no present, only the past rushing into the future. To try to hold fast to it is to be swept aside, and that, my friends, will never happen. Not while I am War Master. Those men who fought and bled with Varvarus shall have this world to stand sentinel over, so that his sacrifice will never be forgotten." Other speakers had said their farewells to the Lord Commander, but none with the War Master's eloquence. True to his word, Horus ensured that army units that had been loyal to Varvarus were appointed to minister the worlds he had died to make compliant. A new Imperial Commander was installed, and the martial power of the fleet began the time-consuming process of regrouping in preparation for the next stage of the Crusade. Carcass's billet stank of ink and printing fumes, the crude mechanical bulk printer working overtime to print enough copies of the latest edition of The Truth Is All We Have. Though his output had been less prolific of late, the Bondsman No. 7 box was nearly empty. Ignace Carcassi remembered wondering, a lifetime ago it seemed, whether or not the lifespan of his creativity could be measured in the quantity of paper he had left to fill. Such thoughts seemed meaningless, given the powerful desire to write that was upon him these days. He sat on the edge of his cot bed, the last remaining place for him to sit, penning the latest scurrilous piece of verse for his pamphlet and humming contentedly to himself. Papers filled the billet, strewn across the floor, tacked upon the walls, or piled on any surface flat enough to hold them. Scribbled notes, abandoned odes, and half-finished poems filled the space. But such was the fecundity of his muse that he didn't expect to exhaust it any time soon. He'd heard that the war with the Eurytians was over, the final citadel having fallen to the sons of Horus a couple of days ago, in what the ship Scuttlebutt was already calling the White Mountains Massacre. He didn't yet know the full story, but several sources he'd cultivated over the 10 months of the war would surely garner him some juicy titbits. He heard a curt knock on his door shutter and shouted, "Come in!" Carcassi kept on writing as the shutter opened, too focused on his words to waste a single second of his time.
"Yes," he said. "What can I do for you?"
No answer was forthcoming, so Carcassi looked up in irritation to see an armored warrior standing mutely before him. At first, Carcassi felt a thrill of panic, seeing the man's longsword and the hard, metallic gleam of a holstered pistol. But he relaxed as he saw that the man was Petrina Lavivar's bodyguard, Magard, or something like that.
"Well," he asked again, "was there something you wanted?"
Magard said nothing, and Carcassi remembered that the man was mute, thinking it foolish that anyone would send someone who couldn't speak as a messenger.
"I can't help you unless you can tell me why you're here," said Carcassi,
speaking slowly to ensure that the man understood. In response, Magard removed a folded piece of paper from his belt and held it out with his left hand. The warrior made no attempt to move closer to him, so with a resigned sigh, Carcassi put aside the bondsman and pushed his bulky frame from the bed. Carcassi picked his way through the piles of notebooks and took the proffered paper. It was a sepia-coloured papyrus, as was produced in Egyptian spires, with cross-hatched patterning throughout. A little gaudy for his tastes, but obviously expensive.
"So, who might this be from?"
asked Carcassy, before again remembering that this messenger couldn't speak. He shook his head with an indulgent smile, unfolded the papyrus, and cast his eyes over the note's contents. He frowned as he recognized the words as lines from his own poetry. Dark imagery and potent symbolism, but they were all out of sequence, plucked from a dozen different works. Carcassy reached the end of the note, and his bladder emptied in terror as he realized the import of the message and its bearer's purpose. Petronella paced the confines of her stateroom, impatient to begin transcribing the latest thoughts of her bodyguard. The time Maggard had spent with the Astartes had been most fruitful, and she had already learned much that would otherwise have been hidden from her. Now a structure suggested itself, a tragic tale told in reverse order that opened on the Primarch's deathbed, with a triumphal coda that spoke of his survival and of the glories yet to come. After all, she didn't want to confine herself to only one book. She even had a prospective title, one that she felt conveyed the correct gravitas of her subject matter, yet also included her in its meaning. Petronella would call this masterpiece In the Footsteps of Gods, and had already taken its first line, the most important part of the tale where her reader was either hooked or left cold, from her own terrified thoughts at the moment of the War Master's collapse. I was there the day that Horus fell. It had all the right tonal qualities, leaving the reader in no doubt that they were about to read something profound, yet keeping the end of the story a jealously guarded secret. Everything was coming together, but Maggard was late in returning from his latest foray into the world of the Astartes, and her patience was wearing thin. She had already reduced Babeth to tears in her impatient frustration, and had banished her maidservant to the tiny chamber that served as her sleeping quarters. She heard the sound of the door to her stateroom opening in the receiving room, and marched straight through to reprimand Maggard for his tardiness. "What time do you call?" she began, but the words trailed off as she saw that the figure standing before her wasn't Maggard. It was the War Master. He was dressed in simple robes and looked more magnificent than she could ever remember seeing him. A fierce anima surrounded him, and she found herself unable to speak as he looked up, the full force of his personality striking her. Standing at the door behind him was the hulking form of First Captain Abaddon. Horus looked up as she entered and nodded to Abaddon, who closed the door at his back. "Miss Viva," said the War Master. It took an effort of will on Petronella's part for her to find her voice.
"Yes, my lord,"
she stammered, horrified at the mess of her stateroom, and that the War Master should see it so untidy. She must remember to punish Babeth for neglecting her duties.
I wasn't expecting—"
Horus held up his hand to soothe her concerns, and she fell silent. "I know I have been neglectful of you," said the War Master. "You have been privy to my innermost thoughts, and I allowed the concerns of the war against the technocracy to command my attention."
"My lord, I never dreamed you gave me such consideration," said Petronella.
"You would be surprised," smiled Horus. "Your writing goes well?"
"Very well, my lord," said Petronella. "I have been prolific since we last met."
"May I see?" asked Horus.
"Of course," she said,
thrilled that he should take an interest in her work. She had to force herself to walk, not run, into her writing room, indicating the papers stacked on her escritoire.
"It's all a bit of a jumble, but everything I've written is here,"
beamed Petronella.
"I would be honored if you would critique my work. After all, who is more qualified?"
"Quite," agreed Horus, following her to the escritoire and taking up her most recent output. His eyes scanned the pages, reading and digesting the contents quicker than any mortal man ever could. She searched his face for any reaction to her words, but he was as unreadable as a statue, and she began to worry that he disapproved. Eventually, he placed the papers back on the escritoire and said, "It is very good. You are a talented documentarist."
"Thank you, my lord,"
she gushed, the power of his praise like a tonic in her veins. "Yes," said Horus, his voice cold. "It's almost a shame that no one will ever read it." Maggard reached up and grabbed the front of Carcassy's robe, spinning him around and hooking his arm around the poet's neck. Carcassy struggled in the powerful grip, helpless against Maggard's superior strength.
"Please,"
he gasped, his terror making his voice shrill.
No, please don't.
Maggard said nothing, and Carcassy heard the snap of leather as the warrior's free hand popped the stud on his holster. Carcassy fought, but he could do nothing, the crushing force of Maggard's arm around his neck robbing him of breath and blurring his vision. Carcassy wept bitter tears as time slowed. He heard the slow rasp of the pistol sliding from its holster and the harsh click as the hammer was drawn back. He bit his tongue. Bloody foam gathered in the corners of his mouth. Snot and tears mingled on his face. His legs scrabbled on the floor. Papers flew in all directions. Cold steel pressed into his neck. The barrel of Maggard's pistol jammed tight under his jaw. Carcassy smelled the gun oil. He wished. The hard bang of the pistol shot echoed deafeningly in the cramped billet. At first, Petronella wasn't sure she'd understood what the War Master meant. Why wouldn't people be able to read her work? Then she saw the cold, merciless light in Horace's eyes.
My lord, I'm not sure I understand you, she said, haltingly.
Yes, you do.
No,
she whispered, backing away from him. The War Master followed her, his steps slow and measured.
When we spoke in the Apothecarium, I let you look inside Pandora's box, Miss Viva, and for that I am truly sorry. Only one person has a need to know the things inside my head, and that person is me. The things I have seen and done, the things I am going to do.
Please, my lord,
said Petronella, backing out of her writing room and into the receiving room.
If you are unhappy with what I've written, it can be revised, edited. I would give you approval on everything, of course.
Horace shook his head, drawing closer to her with every step. Petronella felt her eyes filled with tears, and she knew that this couldn't be happening. The War Master would not be trying to scare her. They must be playing some cruel joke on her. The idea of the Astartes making a fool of her stung Petronella's wounded pride, and the part of her that had snapped angrily at the War Master upon their first meeting rose to the surface.
"I am the Palatina Maioria of House Carpinus, and I demand that you respect that," she cried, standing firm before the War Master. "You can't scare me like this!"
"I'm not trying to scare you," said Horace, reaching out to hold her by the shoulders.
"You're not?"
asked Petronella, his words filling her with relief. She'd known that this couldn't be right, that there had to be some mistake.
"No," said Horace, his hand sliding towards her neck. "I'm illuminating you."
Her neck broke with one swift snap of his wrist. The Medicaid cell was cramped, but clean and well-maintained. Mercedes Ollerton sat by the bed and wept softly to herself, tears running freely down her cold, dark skin. Kirill Sinderman sat with her, and he too shed tears as he held the hand of the bed's occupant.
Euphrates Keeler lay unmoving, her skin pale and smooth, with a sheen to it that made it look like polished ceramic.
Since she had faced the horror in Archive Chamber 3, she had lain unmoving and unresponsive in this Medicaid bay. Sinderman had told Mercedes what had happened, and she found herself torn between wanting to believe him and calling him delusional. His talk of a demon and of Euphrates standing before it with the power of the Emperor pouring through her was too fantastical to be true, wasn't it? She wondered if he'd told anyone else of it. The apothecaries and medics could find nothing physically wrong with Euphrates Keeler, save for the eagle-shaped burn on her hand that refused to fade. Her vital signs were stable, and her brainwave activity registered normal. No one could explain it, and no one had any idea how to wake her from this coma-like state. Mercedes came to visit Euphrates as often as she could, but she knew that Sinderman came every day, spending several hours at a time with her. Sometimes they would sit together, talking to Euphrates, telling her of the events happening on the planets below, the battles that had been fought, or simply passing on ship gossip. Nothing seemed to reach the Imagist, and Mercedes sometimes wondered if it might not be a kindness to let her die. What could be worse for a person like Euphrates than being trapped by her own flesh, with no ability to reason, to communicate or express herself? She and Sinderman had arrived together today, and each instantly knew that the other had been crying.
The news of Ignace Carcassi's suicide had hit them all hard, and Mercedes still couldn't believe how he could have done such a thing. A suicide note had been found in his billet, which was said to have been composed in verse. It spoke volumes of Ignace's enormous conceit that he made his last goodbye in his own poetry. They had wept for another lost soul, and then they sat on either side of Euphrates' bed, holding each other's and Keeler's hands as they spoke of better times. Both turned as they heard a soft knock behind them. A thin-faced man, wearing the uniform of the Legio Mortis and an earnest face, stood framed in the doorway. Behind him, Mercedes could see that the corridor was filled with people.
"Is it all right if I come in?" he asked.
Mercedes Ollerton said, "Who are you?"
"My name's Titus Cassara, Moderati Primus of Dies Irae. I've come to see the saint."
They met in the observation deck. The lighting kept low, and the darkness of space leavened only by the reflected glare of the planets they had just conquered. Loken stood with his palm against the armored viewing bay, believing that something fundamental had happened to the sons of Horus and Aureus, but not knowing what. Togaden joined him moments later, and Loken welcomed him with a brotherly embrace, grateful to have so loyal a comrade. They stood in silence for some time, each lost in thought as they watched the defeated planets turn in space below them. The preparations for departure were virtually complete, and the fleet was ready to move on, though neither warrior had any idea of where they were going. Eventually, Togaden broke the silence.
"So, what do we do?"
"I don't know, Taric," replied Loken. "I really don't."
"I thought not," said Togaden,
holding up a glass test tube with something in it that reflected soft light with a golden gleam.
"This won't help, then."
"What is it?"
asked Loken.
"These," said Togaden, "are the bolt-round fragments removed from Hector Varvarus."
"Bolt-round fragments? Why do you have them?"
"Because they're ours."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean they're ours," repeated Togaden. "The bolt that killed the Lord Commander came from an Astartes bolter, not from one of the Brotherhood's guns."
Loken shook his head.
"No. There must be some mistake."
"There's no mistake. Apothecary Vadin tested these fragments himself. They're ours, no question."
"You think Varvarus caught a stray round?"
Torgadon shook his head.
"The wound was dead center, Garvil. It was an aimed shot."
Loken and Torgadon both understood the implications, and Loken felt his melancholy rise at the thought of Varvarus having been murdered by one of their own. Neither spoke for a long moment. Then Loken said,
"In the wake of such deceit and destruction, shall we despair? Or is faith and honour the spur to action?"
"What's that?"
asked Togaden.
"It's part of a speech I read in a book that Kirill Sinderman gave me," said Loken. "It seemed appropriate given where we find ourselves now."
"That's true enough," agreed Togaden.
"What are we becoming, Taric?" asked Loken. "I don't recognize our legion anymore. When did it change?"
"The moment we encountered the technocracy."
"No," said Loken. "I think it was on Darvin. Nothing's been the same since then. Something happened to the sons of Horus there. Something vile and dark and evil."
"Do you realize what you're saying?"
"I do," replied Loken. "I'm saying that we have to uphold the truth of the Imperium of Mankind, no matter what evil may assail it."
Torgadon nodded.
"The Mournival Oath."
"Evil has found its way into our legion, Taric, and it's up to us to cut it out." "Are you with me?" asked Loken.
"Always," said Togaden,
and the two warriors shook hands in the old Terran way. The War Master's sanctum was dimly lit, the cold glow of the bridge instruments the only source of illumination. The room was full, the core of the War Master's officers and commanders gathered around the table. The War Master sat at his customary place at the head of the table, while Axemand and Abaddon stood behind him, their presence a potent reminder of his authority. Malachurst, Regulus, Erebus, Princeps Turnit of the Legio Mortis, and various other hand-picked army commanders filled out the rest of the gathering. Satisfied that everyone who needed to be there had arrived, Horus leaned forwards and began to speak.
"My friends, We begin the next phase of our campaign among the stars soon, and I know that you're all curious as to where we travel next. I will tell you. But before I do, I need every one of you to be aware of the magnitude of the task before us. He could see he had everyone's attention, and continued. I am going to topple the Emperor from his throne on Terra, and take his place as the master of mankind. The enormity of his words was not lost on the assembled warriors, and he gave them a few minutes to savor their weight, enjoying the look of alarm that crossed each man's face. Be not afraid. You are amongst friends, chuckled Horus. I have spoken to you all individually over the course of the war with the Technocracy, but this is the first time you have been gathered, and I have openly spoken of our destiny. You shall be my war council, those to whom I entrust the furthering of my plan. Horus rose from his seat, continuing to speak as he circled the table. Take a moment, and look at the face of the man sitting next to you. In the coming fight, he will be your brother, for all others will turn from us when we make our intentions plain. Brother will fight brother, and the fate of the galaxy will be the ultimate prize. We will face accusations of heresy and cries of treason, but they will fall from us because we are right. Make no mistake about that. We are right, and the Emperor is wrong. He has sorely misjudged me if he thinks I will stand by while he abandons his realm in his quest for godhood and leaves us amid the destruction of his rampant ambition. The Emperor commands the loyalty of millions of soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Astartes warriors. His battle fleets reach across the stars from one side of the galaxy to the other. The 63rd Expedition cannot hope to match such numbers or resources. You all know this to be the case. But even so, we have the advantage. What advantage is that? Asked Malachurst, exactly on cue. We have the advantage of surprise. No one yet suspects us of having learned the Emperor's true plan, and in that lies our greatest weapon. But what of Magnus? Asked Malachurst urgently. What happens when Leman Russ returns him to Terra? Horus smiled. Calm yourself, Mal. I have already contacted my brother Russ and illuminated him with the full breadth of Magnus's treacherous use of demonic spells and conjurations. He was suitably angry, and I believe I have convinced him that to return Magnus to Terra would be a waste of time and effort. Malachurst returned Horus's smile. Magnus will not leave Prospero alive. No, agreed Horus. He will not. What of the other legions? Asked Regulus. They will not sit idly by while we make war upon the Emperor. How do you propose to negate them? A worthy question, Adept, said Horus, circling the table to stand at his shoulder. We are not without allies ourselves. Fulgrim is with us, and he now goes to win Ferus Manus of the Iron Hands over to our cause. Lorgar, too, understands the necessity of what must be done, and both bring the full might of their legions to my banner. That still leaves many others, pointed out Erebus. Indeed it does, Chaplain. But with your help, others may join us. Under the guise of the Chaplain Edict, we will send emissaries to each of the legions to promulgate the formation of warrior lodges within them. From small beginnings, we may win many to our cause.
That will take time, said Erebus.
Horus nodded. It will, yes, but it will be worth it in the long term. In the meantime, I have dispatched mobilization orders to those legions I do not believe we can sway. The Ultramarines will muster at Kalth to be attacked by Corpharon of the Word-Bearers, and the Blood Angels have been sent to the Cygnus Cluster, where Sanguinius shall be mired in blood. Then we make a swift, decisive stroke on Terra.
That still leaves other legions, said Regulus.
I know, answered Horus. But I have a plan that will remove them as a threat to us once and for all. I will lure them into a trap from which none will escape. I will set the Emperor's Imperium ablaze, and from the ashes will arise a new master of mankind.
And where will you set this trap?
Asked Malachurst. A place not far from here,
said Horace.
The Istvan system.
That was False Gods by Graham McNeil, read by Toby Longworth. This recording is copyrighted by Games Workshop 2014.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.